What up, Long Beach? We've got a possible teacher strike, a mascot fright, and the forgettable Lakers game last night. It's another jam-packed episode of our weekly podcast, keeping you updated on everything happening with the Long Beach schools, their sports teams, and our community at large. As always, I'm JJ Fiddler, and joining me, Mike Arabasio and Tyler Hendrickson.
Always happy to join JJ for the most smoothly produced podcast in all of Long Beach here at What Up Long Beach. Obviously, this podcast brought to you as part of our partnership with the Long Beach Post. Nothing we do with the 562.org would be possible without their support. So go to lbpost.com and support them just as much as you're supporting us.
This podcast is like a womb, well-oiled machine, baby.
We're going to be talking about the new mascot at Cal State Long Beach. Yes, I did not say Long Beach State on purpose. We're going to be talking about the Lakers game last night. It was a tough one. We're going to be talking about our 2012 trip to the London Olympics, because right now we should be basking in the afterglow of the Summer Olympics, and we're not. So we got to scratch that itch. And in our speech and debate segment, you're going to want to stick around for, we're talking about the unwritten rules of sports. But first, breaking news, the biggest news of the week, and it's good news, like we always like to put at the top of this podcast. Long Beach Unified School District will not have to deal with a teacher strike. And we've got a special guest coming on right now to talk to us about it. It is once again Sharhiga, teacher from Jordan High School. Shar, thanks so much for coming by.
Of course. Hi, everybody.
Do I like have to, for journalistic purposes, state that Shar is my wife at the top of the interview?
I literally put it in the script. So yeah, go ahead. Right. This is your shot.
Shar, thanks for joining us from literally the other room in our house. Always great to see you.
Yeah.
How's your day going?
It's okay. I was just about to make lunch, so keep that in mind.
That's fun. What are we having for lunch?
I don't know. You're doing this podcast. I'm the one who's eating.
So, Shar, the big news, and I'm going to give the disclaimer again just to make sure you don't get in trouble, that you are speaking for yourself and not for the Teachers Association of Long Beach or Jordan High School or any of the other many organizations that you represent. But the big news this week was that the Teachers Association of Long Beach and the Long Beach Unified School District have approached an understanding. There's a tentative agreement in place. We expect them to be voting on a memorandum of understanding formally, possibly in the next couple hours, to officially sort of set the rules for what this upcoming school year is going to be and officially avoid a strike, which would have been the first strike in the history of the city for its teachers. I know you've been very stressed about this, and I have thus been really stressed about it, just because this is already going to be such an impossibly difficult year for teachers and students and parents. So can you just, for our listeners, recreate the scene in our house and in your head when, you know, you saw the Facebook post that, okay, there's not going to be a strike this year?
Well, overwhelming relief, certainly. It came later in the evening, I want to say like 10:30, something like that, that we got the email from Dr. Jill Baker, our new superintendent, saying that there had been a tentative agreement reached. Have you guys talked about the strike before? Do your listeners know kind of what it was about? And also, I'm not saying that I don't listen to the podcast. I'm just wondering.
No, get into it, Char.
Okay. So
he doesn't listen to the podcast. That is what she said.
I listen to your part of the podcast. I overhear it from the other room. So there are a lot of sticking points. Obviously, this is a school year unlike any other. Last year, March 13th, when the school district shut down, there was a lot of scrambling to try and keep our teachers working, keep our students learning, as well as all the staff and everything that goes into keeping education going. So there was a lot that was kind of cobbled together to try and just keep everyone afloat. And we talked before about kind of what all that was. So with the ability to have the whole summer to try and figure it out and plan, the goal was to start this school year with a real plan in place. But as a result, that means that we're no longer using kind of emergency rules, right? The school district and the teachers union needed to come together and create a plan that was something that was actually sustainable, that they actually had talked about, discussed, because what the school year is going to be looking like is very different from what is in our contract, from what our normal everyday school year is. And that's, you know, true for the teachers, it's true for staff, it's true for the students, obviously. So the big kind of sticking point between TALB, our union, and the district had to do with where the teachers were going to be located during especially this first month of guaranteed distance learning. The school district announced that at least until October 5th, we're going to be online only. And in the spring, teachers stayed home. There were, eventually we were allowed to go to our classrooms if we needed to get textbooks, to get to supplies. Some lab science teachers went on campus to do their experiments, you know, virtually. So that way they could, you know, obviously you don't necessarily have a Bunsen burner in your house, but you can, you know, go to your classroom to do that. So yeah, hopefully you don't have a Bunsen burner in your house. So in the spring, there was a lot of flexibility around, again, just what can we do day by day in order to make things work. In order to set it up for the fall, we needed a real plan. And the school district's plan initially was to require that all teachers be on campus, still doing distance learning. So virtual learning, virtual teaching, but the teachers are on campus in their rooms, broadcasting into, you know, their students' homes from their classroom. That was given out as the plan from the school district, from what I understand, before really there had been that conversation with the union to make that agreement. So the union kind of fired back and said, we didn't agree to that, and brought up a lot of really valid concerns about how it's less safe to be on campus than it is to be in someone's house. Now, there's the school district has promised, and it's you know, I take them at their word that they're taking real steps in order to make it as safe as possible. And so that means, you know, only one teacher in a room, there's going to be COVID screenings, all of these things, but necessarily leaving your house increases your risk, right? And so the school district and the union were really at odds with each other over especially that one sticking point. There are a number of other details that still need to be hammered out, but that was kind of the big sticking point.
And if I could just sort of explain why this was something that became a fight that dragged on for more than a month. The reason that the school district said they were pushing for that was there were fairly significant numbers of teachers who had connectivity problems from their houses in the spring. And so right. a major complaint that the district got, especially in the poorer parts of the city, was my teachers weren't logging on. They were saying they didn't have the internet to do the video teaching. You know, these things are going to be requirements in the fall. And I think we heard the district saying, we want teachers in the classroom so that we can take ownership of that problem. You're on our Wi-Fi. If it screws up, it's our job to fix it. And teachers then obviously had the complaint that Char mentioned, which, you know, certainly makes a lot of sense. And I think they landed in what was a fairly reasonable compromise position of the district is going to allow flexibility for almost all of the teachers. There's some early education and special education teachers who will not have flexibility. But almost all teachers are getting that option. But in order to teach from home, they're going to have to sign an agreement that says, right, I'm going to have these things in my house. I'm sure there's going to be an internet speed test to guarantee that they have the setup to do it. You're someone who I think is really representative of teachers in our generation, where you really care about the kids. I know this from being around you so much. You really care about the kids, and you're really worried about what they're going through. And then also, you're the department head at your school, and you personally know people that have medical situations that they don't want to leave their house. They're not leaving the house. They're not leaving the house to grocery shop. They're not leaving the house to socialize. But I think one thing you and I talked about quite a bit, and I'll dial down both of our language in summarizing that conversation, is it just felt like it got so virulent, you know, in kind of both directions. And I think anytime you talk about a potentially historic strike, that's going to happen. But are you hopeful that there's going to be a little bit of a kumbaya moment here, that everyone, from the students to the parents to the teachers to the district, everyone's sort of going into this school year together in a week and a half? Or do you think this is something where everyone's still going to be, you know, kind of pissed off at each other for the next year?
I think there's a little bit of both. I think that the anxiety, a lot of people will talk about getting summers off and how that's nice for the profession. Obviously, that is a selling point for our profession. My parents were both high school teachers. I loved that we got to have summers off together. It's great. But what people don't always recognize is that that there's a lot of anxiety that comes around, especially when the beginning of the school year includes some change, right? So if I'm teaching a new class, If I'm at a different school site, even just, I mean, you remember back in when you were in school, there's that the night before the first day of school kind of anxiety because you don't know what it's going to be like. That's true for teachers too. And it kind of, in order for it to work, you have to have a sense of this is what it's going to look like. And it's my classroom and I know where things are. And so I don't know who's walking through the door when the bell rings, but this is what I do know. And so that unknown has been really, really stressful and really, really difficult. And I think that because the conversation has lasted all summer, I think that anxiety really ramped up and continues to ramp up. And we're not just talking about like, I'd prefer this versus another, where we are really talking about life or death conversations here. And it's not just true for teachers, it's true for students as well. It's true for families. There's all sorts of moving pieces here. And I don't blame anyone for being really stressed and upset. I don't blame people for being frustrated, because we're talking about a drastic shift in what's been considered normal forever, right? A drastic shift where it's like, okay, and then late August, early September, the students go back to school, right? And the teachers are there and parents can go back to doing their thing and then helping with homework at the end of the day. Like, there's ways that this is supposed to work. And the fact that everything's been upended, I think that a lot of the stress that's just been around COVID and around the shutdown and the election, and just like, there's a lot of stuff and chaos going around. And so it kind of cycled, condensed into Facebook conversations, which is never a good place for that to land.
It's not the most constructive place for empathetic, meaningful conversations.
But to answer your other question, Mike, I do think that once the school year starts, there has historically been a like, and then you're in it. And you're in it together. And I think that once the school year starts, I think that we'll kind of be able to get back on the same team. But there's been some really nasty stuff said, especially again on Facebook online, both, you know, teachers being frustrated with the district, parents saying some really like hurtful things about teachers. So I'm hoping that once we get a sense of, okay, this is now what the new normal looks like, and we kind of settle into that, that we can kind of look at each other and say, okay, we're all trying to do the best we can for students and in order to keep, you know, to keep society going. Not to oversell.
Great stuff as always, Char. We got one question before we let you go. Are we just going to do this again when we actually figure out when everybody can go back on campus? Is this whole thing going to happen again where some people have certain expectations here, some people have certain expectations there, and they're still angry about the process that they just went through?
Well, again, JJ, the anger is not just about the process, right? The anger is about everything, right? So back in March when we shut down, there was a sense of like, and then this is going to last until June.
Right.
And then we're going to be back on campus in the fall. And so that finish line now has completely disappeared, and it's not like it's been moved. We don't know when it's going to be back to normal. And so all of the anxiety, there was this sense of like, but there's this thing that we can look forward to. And that being shaky now, I don't blame anyone for being upset. Like, it's a really difficult time to be living in. And yeah, things are going to continue to change, right? Like, where we are right now, it certainly doesn't look like we're going to be back on campus on October 5th. And even if we are back on campus, that's, you know, with social distancing, that's with, you know, requiring students to wear masks. It's with all these things that are still really weird. What we're looking forward to is when it's normal, like the normal chaos of the beginning of the school year, the normal chaos of high school students, you know, 30 to 35 of them in a classroom, sneezing on each other, like all of the normal stuff that like we've got a system in place for, as opposed to, okay, so I'm on high alert at every moment because someone might slip their mask under their nose and then all the alarm bells are going to go off, right? Like, that's not how this system's supposed to work. So yeah, I think that we've got more difficult conversations ahead, but once this MOU, this Memorandum of Understanding between the school district and TALB, our union, gets hammered out, once we get the school year started, once we kind of get a sense of this is my team, these are my students, I think that hopefully some of that anxiety will be ratcheted down, and then we can do a little bit more of thinking on our feet.
Well, thank God part of it worked. and everybody can go back to school in one way, shape, or form. Thank you so much for stopping by, Shar. We always appreciate you, and good luck out there. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Thank you.
So as we get back into the podcast, we have to reiterate, stories like that are only found at the 562.org and Long Beach Post right now. That's where you're going to find this education information. And the reason why you get it is because the community supports those websites. And the way you support those websites is by subscribing. Right, Tyler?
That's absolutely right, JJ. You should go to the 562.org. There is a subscribe button right there at the top of your screen. It's black and yellow. Popular colors in the city in certain aspects of the community. We'll, more on that later. But go ahead and hit that subscribe button. It'll take you to our Patreon page. That's where you can become a subscriber for as little as $1 a month. And no contributions too small. Subscribe. Let us know you love what the 562 does and help us stay around for the long term so we can keep bringing you this great quality, locally sourced and accurate information on Long Beach, its sports, its schools, and the community at large. That's what we do.
You may or may not have noticed that it is somewhat hot outside right now. Have you guys noticed that?
Indeed.
I personally, whenever it gets this hot, I think two things. Number one, I need to sit inside in the air conditioning. And number two, I want some barbecue. It's too hot for me to go outside and actually cook myself, but that is just what I naturally crave when my body is, you know, you need some barbecue sauce to replace all the sweat that you're sweating out right now. So my suggestion for you is to do exactly what my family's doing this week. You've probably seen us posting about it on social media. We like to let everyone know when we go down to Naples Rib Company for the best barbecue in town and also the best community partner you could ever ask for. Naples Rib Company continues to support us as well as other charities in the community through this pandemic. So you need to go down to Naples Rib Company, get your takeout order. You know, if you can stand the heat, sit out. They do the outdoor dining there now throughout this pandemic. But definitely make sure to tell them that the 562.org thing.
If you're a Long Beach State Athletics fan, I can guarantee you, you've been frustrated with the mascot and branding switches and changes that have been happening over the last 4 years. I mean, it started with not doing 49ers. It ended with, we want to do Long Beach State. And now we're here with LB, the shark, that is the mascot for the college and not actually the athletic department. So it's real hard to explain, and we're going to try to do that right now.
Okay, first of all, before we get started, we did a live show. This is the 10th LB the Shark related product that we put out, okay? So if we sound a little extra annoyed, it's because we're genuinely just very tired of it. We started the live chat with the Post yesterday with me asking a question to JJ. I'm going to ask it again, and I guess this is more for Tyler since JJ already answered on the live stream, but you die, there's a white flash, everything is peaceful, all your anxiety disappears, and then you're pulled back into existence, and the first thing that happens is someone's telling you, oh, hey, Long Beach State changed their mascot. You got to write something about that real quick. Are you in A, hell, or B, purgatory?
I'm going with LB, purgatory, because it is the problem that will not die and will not go away. So that's what it feels like. There's no finality. It's like hell would at least be somewhat comforting because you know, like, well, this is my existence. You know, the decision was hell, not limbo forever. You know, it's too much limbo.
I hate to play the expert card here, but there is a chance you could go to heaven while in purgatory. If you're in hell, you're in hell. Purgatory, you could go either way. I just don't think we're going to get to a point where Long Beach State fans are like, you know who I love? LB the Shark.
You know, I don't know. There was an argument someone made on our Twitter account, and I hope you guys co-sign this because it was too early for us to hop on a Zoom call and discuss our LB the Shark strategy. I just posted two screenshots on our Twitter account, and I was like, what do you guys think about it? Obviously, it was like 98% negative. There were some people who were positive. There was one comment to what JJ just said that I kind of agreed with, which was basically everyone's always mad whenever there's a new branding or logo or uniform or whatever, with very few exceptions that someone crushes a uniform. People are generally always mad.
They love the court, though. The court's always got positive feedback. Anyway, keep going.
Correct. But they're like, you know, don't you feel – but, you know, no one liked the beach logo. Like, all this stuff drew fire when I was – and they're like, don't you feel like in 10 years it'll just be there? And to some extent, I do kind of think that. You know what I mean? Like, if it's there and you're in the pyramid with your kids And, you know, the basketball team wins a championship. The men's volleyball team wins another NCAA championship. I'll still make fun of them, but I made fun of Prospector Pete, too. So I don't know.
When you say the word there, I'm really not sure what you're talking about, because the athletic department was not part of this rollout of the brand new mascot. The mascot that Mike just said, the Prospector Pete problem, is campus-wide for sure. But the LB situation is more upper campus, for those of you who know the Long Beach State layout. It's a university thing, a college thing, not an athletic department thing. So we're not going to see LB the Shark dancing around at sporting events like we would have seen Prospector Pete if he was still around. Both not actual people or actual animals, by the way, I just want to say. This is all part of getting rid of the 49er because of the ties to, you know, the obviously the genocide of the indigenous people of the Western states or future Western states, quote unquote. It was started on campus. It's part of what I would consider a self-correction, not really cancel culture. There's a lot of things that are named, a lot of things that shouldn't be named that way. And I think a lot of people who just look in front of them, see the thing they don't like, and then go after that with gusto as if everything was called Robert E. Lee High School. I understand. I get that. But this execution of the rollout of LB, the new quote-unquote mascot for the university, it was a bit fumbled in that the costume's not good, right? It doesn't have the colors of the school. The LB thing on the front looks like somebody, you know, ironed it on, as if you're putting an AYSO patch on your jersey. It just doesn't look great. And the design doesn't look great and all that stuff. And I think that was people's initial reaction, was that doesn't look cool. Right. You know, whether or not it was a shark or a lion or a tiger or a bear, oh my, I don't think it mattered. I think people just didn't like the way it looked and the way it was rolled out and the video that they put out and stuff like that. And I think that the momentum of negativity is the biggest momentum of all.
Well, you only have one chance at a first impression, right? And it came off very rushed, very like little attention to detail. Like you said, it didn't seem tailored or fit. There was a lot of questionable decisions, including a shark having hands, which I didn't really gather, or massive biceps that make me look like Manute Bol.
LB the Shark does not miss arm day.
I guess the confusion there is what was the hurry to get this done? You know, who was clamoring for this? So why rush it and have it appeared rushed, at least. And if it wasn't rushed and appeared rushed, that's its own problem. But also, what's the role of LB? What's the point? Because you've taken a sports concept of having a mascot that is related to athletics, but you're specifically not having it involved in athletics. So you have non-sports people making a sports decision for non-sports things. So if someone's going to be in the library and LB's going to come by with absolute tractor that it's pulling back there and knock my homework off the table.
But plowing two lanes down the fifth floor of the library.
It's got its fins flapping, you know, just going crazy in the library. Like, what's the point of having it? I don't understand.
If I can offer one clarification, since this is like the Russian nesting doll of clarification story, that like you just keep needing further and further layers of clarification. Okay, I'll do it in verbal meme galaxy brain form. Okay, we all know the galaxy brain meme.
Oh, I'm aware.
Yep.
Okay, step one. Oh my God, the sports teams are called the Shark. Step two, the mascot name change does not apply to sports, right? And we are all on this same wavelength. They're not going to be the Sharks. All the sports teams will still be the Beach. The Dirtbags will still be the Dirtbags. Galaxy Brain is, I believe Jane Connolly did say last year, and I think Andy Fee said the same thing, they're not going to call the teams the Sharks, but the mascot that gets unveiled probably will be dancing at sporting events and graduation. So it'll just be like like similar to, and JJ's going to love this analogy, Fullerton is the Titans. The elephant is not a Titan. It's just the mascot. I think that's what you're going to see. You will see a shark going around saying go Beach at Long Beach State sporting events. That's what I'm expecting.
First of all, I think the people from Fullerton do actually think an elephant is a Titan. Second of all, after the reaction, I don't think anybody is clamoring to see LB right now, both from the administration standpoint and also the athletic and fan standpoint. I don't think anybody's like, okay, great, rollout. When are we first going to have LB in the pyramid? I don't think that's where they're going with it, because I think overall everybody's realizing we didn't need to do this. Why did we do this? We could have just easily gone without a mascot. As I said on that live chat thing with Steve Lowry in the Long Beach Post, It could have just been Go Beach. Go Beach is our Roll Tide. You don't need a mascot to say Go Beach. You don't need a mascot for people to refer to you as the beach, which will continue to be the case for the Long Beach State athletics teams. You just don't need it. This is just completely and utterly unnecessary. He could have gotten rid of Prospector Pete and just moved on.
It's a school with too many identities looking for new identities. And it's like, it makes less than sense. Long Beach State, CSULB, Cal State Long Beach, 49ers Beach, Dirtbags, Sharks, LB, Prospector Pete. My mind's exploded. It doesn't. You can't even get the right LB half the time.
And memo to sports fans, we're going to see this more often than not in the very near future. I mean, like I said on that live chat, the CSU system has told its schools to get rid of individuals as mascots. So I'm looking at you, CSUN, the Matadors. I'm looking at you, UCSB, the Gauchos.
San Diego State's a big one.
I think those are next on the chopping block.
Oh, listen, they've reconvened in the Long Beach Unified School District's Board of Education has reconvened its school renaming. So I think we'll be taking a very serious look at Wilson, Jordan, Cabrillo, and Milliken High School's names over the upcoming school year. This will be an ongoing story for sure.
And I want to get in front of the narrative that I think will come with that stuff where people will react, oh man, look at the cancel culture out of control. That is not the case. If you have been paying attention to the most recent high schools built in Southern California, specifically in the Inland Empire, and I think I've said this before, you've got Centennial Huskies, you've got Santiago Sharks, Chaparral Pumas, Great Oak Wolfpack. These are places and animals, not people and things. It's very obvious to me that people realize we gotta stop naming our schools after controversial things. That happened a long time ago. Centennial Huskies has been around for a while. They could have named that thing anything, but they went with something simple. I think we're going to see that a lot more. And like I said, it's not a cancel culture. It's a self-correction. We never should have named anything Robert E. Lee. We just shouldn't have done it. But now we get to fix it.
Well, we already fixed that one. So to me, there's a big difference between a Woodrow Wilson and a Robert E. Lee. Well, I mean, in Long Beach, at least, we took Robert E. Lee's name off the elementary school. I'm talking about our city.
I'm talking about the world at large.
No doubt. You know, and listen, and I'll say this, cancel culture's got nothing to do with Confederate generals. I mean, I personally believe the Confederacy, Confederate monuments is a class of stuff that we should all collectively be able to go, they're literally against the country that we're all living in. Like, that to me should be an easy one.
It's a traitorous stain. It's a stain on the country, flat out.
Right, so that's a very different conversation from Woodrow Wilson, David Starr Jordan. I'm not saying those people are good people, but there's a big difference between a Confederate general who was fighting for slavery and someone who was, like most of the people we've elected president in this country, maybe not a great person.
Mike, I'd love to think that, but from reading people's reaction online, and I know that's probably not the best place to get information, but I don't think that's how people think.
No,
of it.
I agree.
I think they lump all of that in together, and I think that the approach to the idea of canceling something or changing something or fixing something has to take into account that people don't separate.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I find the school renaming thing to be really tricky, because unlike a Robert E. Lee or something, there is genuinely great history at Wilson High School. And it has been associated with the name Wilson High School. I don't think most kids who have gone to school there know anything about Woodrow Wilson or care anything about Woodrow Wilson, but the name of the school they went to is Wilson High School. And I think it's understandable with the schools like we have in Long Beach that have this incredible history and tradition, you know, and people who remember being 16, 17 and singing the names of these schools and stuff. Like, it's understandable that people are defensive about what they see as their history. They don't necessarily feel they're defending racism when they defend the name of Wilson High School. I hope that there's some sort of a middle ground in there. My thing has been, let's make it a Long Beach Wilson High School, Long Beach Jordan High School, Long Beach Milliken High School, to preserve the history while say, yeah, we don't need to honor David Starr Jordan, but the name of this basketball team has been the Jordan basketball team forever. I don't think we need to wipe that history away with David Starr Jordan, who, again, I don't think most people know who that is.
And it's also a great opportunity to teach a young kid why it was called David Starr Jordan, why people said that the things that he thought were not correct or inappropriate, and then we changed it. That's a great lesson.
Let's not fall into the same mistake. Let's not try to necessarily find a new person to name things after. The people that are saying, I don't want it to change from Jordan, I don't want to change it from Wilson, they're not caping for Woodrow Wilson. They're not caping for, you know, Robert Starr Jordan. They are connected to the name and what was on their high school sweatshirt or what their, you know, where their grandfather went to school, because it's a multi-generational. So as long as they can say, my grandfather went to Wilson and now I go to Wilson, and not, you know, insert other name here, right, you're still keeping that connection. You don't have to honor the person. Like Mike said, that's the absolute correct solution. Call it Long Beach Jordan, Long Beach Wilson. So you still have that history. And then if people say, well, why was it Wilson? You could say, well, it was named after this president who ended up, obviously, as time evolved, had problematic views on things. And we felt it was more appropriate to the community to take his first name off the school. Very simple, very clean. Nothing goes out of date. You can still call it J-Town, which you need. That is essential at Jordan, is to call it, be able to call it J-Town still. Just call it Long Beach Jordan. And then, boom, you barely have to change any signage. Everything's fine.
One thing we can all agree on is that 2020 sucks. It's the worst year ever, personally, professionally. No one's having a good time. And so if you're like me, I am not really a living in the past kind of a guy. I say that even as someone who's written 3 books about the history of the city. But one thing we have been doing unabashedly in my house is indulging in nostalgia. When my kids miss going to the aquarium, I go in my Apple Photos, I type in the word aquarium to search all the photos we've taken there, and we throw them up on the TV. And in that vein, something JJ and I have been doing quite a bit of is talking about the London Olympics trip that we took in 2012. JJ has a terrific story in this week's Grunion Gazette, as well as on the 562.org. That's kind of an oral history of what ended up being a once-in-a-lifetime trip for us. And I think this is the perfect time to talk about it, because we're just a few days after what would have been the closing ceremonies in Tokyo. And I would add that also this Friday was supposed to be the first high school football games of the year as well. So this is really a week when both of us have been thinking, this would have been awesome. Lots of great stuff would have been going on. And instead, we're looking at, you know, at least a few more months of inactivity before things start up. So first of all, thank you for putting this together, JJ. It was great to read it and be a part of it.
Oh, absolutely. It was emotional. You know what I mean? I absolutely want to pull a Rick and Morty and go find the other timeline where we get the Olympics and the first football game this week. But since we can't, let's go back.
Please,
in time.
Can we? Can we try harder?
Yeah. Let's go back and look at 2012. 2012, we had just gotten the jobs that we had at the Grunion Gazette. And obviously the publisher, Simon Grieve, who is from London, England, knew that the Olympics were going to be in London and had the idea, even before he talked to us, that he would want to send somebody to London to cover Long Beach as if it was its own country. Little did we know that we would have more than 30 athletes and coaches with ties to Long Beach competing in the 2012 Summer Olympics in London. So Simon got a group of sponsors together. I mean, we got to shout out Sue LaBounty. We got to shout out the Aquatic Capital of America, especially got to shout out the Long Beach Century Club, Dan Gooch, who put together a most expensive hot dog and hamburger barbecue in the world to raise some money for us so that we could actually eat while we were over there. 3 weeks, you guys. Simon sent us to London for 3 weeks. Doors open to doors closed. We were there for the opening ceremonies, there for the closing ceremonies, and everything in between that happened with Long Beach, like Brishon Nelum carrying the flag for the United States of America after going to Long Beach Poly and USC. Misty May Traynor winning that amazing third gold medal with her partner, Carrie Walsh. And everything else that we saw, just the little stuff from like the rowing stuff, you know what I mean? Michaela Maroney. We didn't even know Michaela Maroney was going to be a worldwide sensation when we left. But when we got back, she was a meme.
She was, I think, actually in the Oval Office meeting Barack Obama on the day that we flew home from London. And yeah, she was someone who was only even on our radar because I was on vacation with my wife, with Char, who is on the podcast, right before we left for London when the gymnastics trials happened. And she was going up there to do the vault, and they just happened to have below her, like, Michaela Maroney, hometown Long Beach, California. And I texted you, like, I think we just got another Olympian.
And that kept happening in the buildup. We finally got there. We lived in a room inside of a house in Blackheath, which is just outside of London. So we were taking the tubes and the double-decker buses, classic London style, pretty much 3 weeks straight, getting to, I think we ended up going to 7 different venues that were hosting like 10 different Olympic events.
I mean, it was constant movement from when we landed until when we left. We had, I think, one day off in 3 weeks. We were working an average of like 16 to 18 hours a day. And we had like one day, to the extent that you'd literally be like, hey, we don't have anything from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. I'm going to sleep during that time. Like, you knew that, like, it was Monday and you're like, Thursday, I've got 2 hours at dawn, you know? Yeah. The one day we had off, we went to Ireland because, you know, if you're trying to fly to Ireland from here, it costs you, you know, hundreds of dollars. If you're trying to fly to Ireland from London, it's like going to San Francisco. Like, what it costs is like $40 or something.
Yeah, it's 99 euro, which is about 60 bucks.
For both of us or whatever. So what was fun to me about this was going back and looking at the pictures and trying to separate those memories out, because I just have so many things that have kind of blurred together over 8 years. And I think for me in particular, the Olympics was a real dividing line, because Shar and I had our son Vincent the next summer. Like, she got pregnant like a month after we got back. So it's like, it was a real, like, there was life up till this point. We came home from the Olympics and then we've had kids since then, you know?
No, you're absolutely right. And even going back and trying to find information, you know, in the old pictures and the old stories and stuff like that, to put this oral history together that, like we said, you can find at the 562.org right now. It was so emotional, just personally, but also professionally, right? Very specifically, there was one night where Team GB track and field program had a historic night. They won 3 gold medals. They had never done it before. It was amazing. We were sitting at the table and I wanted to go. And Michael was like, dude, don't leave right now. And we got into an argument and I stormed out in a huff and I was like, forget this. I'm going to go find a story, right? I was wanted to be gonzo journalism to the tilt. I went out there and I couldn't find anything. I felt so embarrassed that I had like demanded to leave. And then I went out there and like there was nothing cool happening. I thought I was going to go out and find a riot of celebration,
right.
But it wasn't there. But on the tube back, and you guys can check out this story, on the tube back, I sat next to this family and they had this like emotional moment. And the father looking at his son when his son is like, daddy, we saw 3 gold medals. I started crying when I read it, bro, because I realized JJ in that moment was so bummed and so trying so hard to be a journalist. But the moment that I found the best story I found was when I turned that off.
Right.
Sometimes you just got to let the story tell itself and then you tell the story, as opposing to trying to go find it and chase it and grab it, because I wouldn't have been on the tube to see that. And I swear to God, sometimes when I'm really stressed out, I think, daddy, we just saw 3 gold medals. And it like calms me down.
That's great.
Because that's where the stories are, dude. They're where you're not looking for them.
I think that was definitely, for me, it was an interesting career point, because we had reached a certain level of prominence within the city. You know, when we started out 2007, 2008, it was a little bit of a pirate flag operation. You know, I mean, we got our knuckles wrapped for doing all kinds of crap we weren't supposed to do. We were writing articles about how to, you know, we had Zumi's article about how to sneak into the Grand Prix. I mean, we're doing all kinds of stuff that was just like, hey, here's these 22, 23-year-old kids that are trying to do something new, and JJ's videos were popular. But by 2012, it was kind of like we'd won several statewide awards. We had been breaking all of the big sports news in the city for a couple of years at that point. And I was going into London feeling that pressure that you were describing of like, should I start dressing nicer? You know, like what, how do I be a grown-up journalist? Cause I didn't go to journalism school, you know, everything I knew about journalism I'd learned from JJ. And London for me was great because it was where we went. We didn't have press. We were not credentialed by the USOC. Like, the trip came together like a month before the Olympics. So it was already at that point, like a year too late to get real credentials. So it was great for me because it was like, here's how you do a big journalistic enterprise, but with that same black flag mentality that we'd always had when we were younger. And so it was like, okay, it's working with USA Basketball and Volleyball to get to practices, to get interviews for features. It's meeting Jessica Hardy and her parents in the Olympic Village to get that behind the scenes story. But for me, it was letting, exactly what you said, letting go of that journalistic, like, everything's got to be by the books and, you know, whatever else. And just remembering, like, journalism is more of a practice than it is a profession, in my opinion, if that makes sense. And that kind of like we went to a pin trading area, and I love that stuff. You just parachute in and you're looking around and you're going, these people care more about this than I care about anything. And like, why is that? You and I both are of the same mentality. We're like, we are not pin traders, but we're really fascinated by people. And that whole trip was just like, walk into a pub, look around, find the interesting story. And it's exactly what you just said. The way you find it is by not looking for it. It's by going to the pub. You sit down, you grab a beer, we go outside, we go for a walk, and you run into the story when you're not trying to force it.
I mean, Hunter S. Thompson, one of my heroes, would be so proud of us. We didn't have press credentials, and we met Kobe Bryant, RIP. Are you serious?
Yeah.
How did we do that?
Right. We got into a USA basketball practice. We got to interview Kobe and Kevin Durant and, you know, and see that LeBron James was not interested in ever having contact with the media first, and he wasn't forced to. You know, we got Russell Westbrook to say what up Long Beach. I mean, it just, the whole thing was pretty incredible for sure.
Unbelievable. And what made it great was Long Beach. We could have gone out there and done the exact same thing that we did, but to have Long Beach perform like it did in the London Olympics, we just couldn't ask for anything more. The medal totals are ridiculous. And as a teaser, go to the 562.org right now. At the top of that article, you can see the medal totals from 2012 in London and how Long Beach outperformed some of the biggest countries in the world.
And now time for a little speech and debate as we try to wrap this episode up. A very action-packed episode, so we'll try to keep this one quick. The topic that's on my mind that I want to sort of about a little bit, unwritten rules in sports. There's a lot of them across many different sports. Baseball has been in the news lately as far as unwritten rules of apparently you're not supposed to swing at 3-0 pitches when you're up late in a game. So what are some of the unwritten rules that you guys think are the most dumb in sports, and what are just overall take? Go.
Well, you're absolutely right. They are dumb. If they were good rules, they'd be written down. Because if a rule leads to someone getting hurt, it's a bad rule. You've got a rule in there so people can injure each other. Like, the answer to the Tatis Grand Slam in a quote-unquote blowout was to hit the next guy. Guys, that's really dangerous to throw a ball 90 miles an hour at somebody. That's a really dangerous situation. And what you're telling yourself, your fans, and your sport is that that's the answer. Stop doing that stuff. Seriously, somebody's going to get injured because of something that somebody decided a long time ago and everybody else was like, good idea, but not good enough to write down.
I think my glib answer to Tyler's question is I just would say that I generally find baseball's unwritten rules to be very stupid, like as a whole. And I'm glad to be part of a younger generation where I think it's a little more acceptable to say that now. Like, we have good friends of ours, like Andrew Ramos, who is about as big a baseball guy as you could ever meet in your life. You know, I mean, like, genuinely loves baseball more than maybe anyone else I know loves any sport, and also feels that way about the unwritten rules, that it's like, hey, I actually believe the MLB's ads about kids should be able to have fun and that sports should be an enjoyable thing for people to do. And now that doesn't necessarily mean you're stealing bases in the top of the ninth inning up by 15 runs, but it means that if it's 3-0 and you're having a great season and you're, you know, Tatis, and someone throws you an easy fastball, like, you go yard with the bases loaded. that's playing baseball. Like, if the unwritten rule is you shouldn't play the sport, then it's kind of tough to follow that.
Are we working in a world now where any type of running up the score is in violation of an unwritten rule? I would take violating an unwritten rule and running the game up as two different situations. Like, everybody knows Steve Spurrier was running up the game so that he could get his team higher in the rankings because that's what people cared about. If you run up the score, I feel like that's not even an unwritten rule. That's just running up the score.
Well, it's also worth noting that, like, Steve Spurrier is operating in a system where they reward you for running up the score. So
exactly.
I mean, it's like, what's the guy supposed to do? I think,
does Tatis not want another home run and four more RBIs next time he's negotiating his contract? Not going to help him?
Yeah, but I think this is something we've all talked about quite a bit around sportsmanship. Because first of all, those unwritten rules have a different place to me in high school sports or youth sports than they do in Major League Baseball.
If you're a professional pitcher,
bro, get the outs. You only got to get 27 of them to end the game.
Without question.
But I would even say it's just context is so important. We've all talked about this. Carl Buggs, girls basketball coach at Poly, is on record saying he'd pull his whole team off the floor before he'd score 100 points on a team. And it's not because he thinks that scoring 100 versus 99 against an overmatched opponent when you've put all your backups in the second quarter, when you're not shooting three-pointers, right? Like, there's no difference between those things, but he knows if people see 100, they're going to assume that he was trying to embarrass the other team. And I think similarly, you look at a game like the Antonio Pierce poly football game, 99-9 against Compton. Like, JJ is texting me during that game going like, it's Raul Lara was texting me during the game going, they're not really up by 80 something points right now, are they? And my response to everyone was just like, you're going to have to look at the video to get the context, because it's what we talked about. There's 6 minutes left in the fourth quarter. The game is way out of hand, but the refs haven't called it. What are you doing? You're running halfback dive plays and they're going for a 60-yard touchdown. Is it the unwritten rule correct thing to lay down on the 1 yard line? Like, if my kid's playing for the other team, that's way more insulting to me. And if I'm a fan of whoever it was that Tatis went yard against, I don't want to see this dude taking like he's playing baseball.
Right.
Unwritten rules are situational. That's why they're unwritten, because every situation dictates how you deal with it, which also is why they're stupid.
Right. Well, and there was 10 other arms in that bullpen that they could have gone to. If this guy was physically incapable of getting outs,
exactly,
which he's being paid to do, bring in another guy to try to do it. It's ludicrous to worry about another professional athlete's feelings when literally all you're doing is your job, which is to get on base and not make outs. That's the point every time you go up to the plate. One that I want to throw out there that really bugs me is the you can't win MVP on a losing team.
Agreed.
A team with a losing record. I don't think that makes sense. If you're the best player, you're the best player. And sometimes you can be the best player on the planet and you're surrounded by people that aren't very good. Here's to you, Mike Trout, for the past 5 years. But like, that is a dumb rule to me. And I know it's still prevalent in the NBA and in college. Only once has a player won the Heisman Trophy on a team with a losing record. And of course, it was a Notre Dame player, Paul Hornung. And of course, it was only done so they could prevent the University of Tennessee from getting the Heisman Trophy, because it should have gone to Johnny Majors. Now, I'm not saying that they were wrong to not – they shouldn't have not given it to him because he was on a losing team, and Notre Dame was 2-8 that year. But it is funny that the only exception's made for Notre Dame, and I'll leave it at that.
Tyler preaching from high atop Rocky Top. I love
it. It's an unwritten rule to make an exception for Notre Dame.
It's a Big Ten bias. Peyton Manning on line two. The one time you give it to a defensive player, it's against Peyton Manning. Yeah, I'd see a pattern.
I'll tell you what. We need an unwritten rule that if a Lakers player not named LeBron James or AD shoots 5 three-pointers and misses all of them, they're not allowed to shoot a three-pointer again in that game.
You mean that series?
Or maybe even the series. Yeah, that's good. Lakers obviously getting knocked off by the Blazers last night. It was certainly Dame time. And it was tough for Laker fans to watch because – and I'll start it here, guys. I am very nervous, not only for this series against the Blazers, but for the playoffs as a whole, because as a Laker fan, I have seen great coaching and I have seen bad coaching. And I'm just going to start calling him Fogle from now on. Frank Vogel is just Fogle from Superbad, because he is McLovin. He's got a plan. He's got the tools to execute that plan, but that's all. He's not creative when he gets there. He's not ready for any wrinkles. He's running the exact same offense with the exact same defense over and over and over and over again. And it was clear last night that the Blazers were willing to try more different type of stuff. And Fogel is just kind of like, you guys are you. Why don't you go just do your thing? There's just no creativity in the coaching for the Lakers right now. And I think that's going to come back to bite him either in this series or the next one, or especially against the Clippers.
And I hope he pulls up dressed like a pirate.
Without question. I need that vest. I need that vest, Tyler.
I'm going to disagree with you on Vogel. I thought defensively I was really impressed with the game plan. Like you hold the Blazers to, I think, 25.5 points below their bubble average. It's the lowest number of points that the Blazers have scored this season in a win. And I think
that wasn't because that they were not getting good shots.
No, that's not true. You hold Dame Lillard, you hold the bubble MVP for almost two full quarters consecutively with no field goals. And I disagree with you. I know everyone's killing KCP and Danny Green, and offensively they're horrific. But the lineup was put out there because that's a Lakers team that believes if we hold this team to 100 points, there's no way we're going to lose the game. And the offense was so bad that they were wrong. But I don't think.
But it didn't work last night, and it also hasn't worked that much in the bubble. The Lakers have not played well in the bubble. We can all agree on that.
I mean, I would say that I find it difficult. Like, yes, I agree with you, but I also find it difficult to evaluate because very clearly what they were trying to do in the bubble was beat the Clippers, get the one seed, and then rest for the playoffs. So, but you know, all the people are saying like, Where's Deion Waiters? Like, Damian Lillard has 900 points last night if they run a different defense against that dude than they did. And that's a guaranteed way for us to lose a game because we can't score with the Blazers. So, to me, you know, almost every three-pointer that the Lakers missed, and there were 30 of them, was wide open. Like, you have to make shots. And if they're not making shots, we've seen that. How many times have we seen this exact game plan situation for the Poly boys basketball team? Where you've got better big men, you're better athletically, but you don't have shooters, right? You play good defense. So there's two things you can do. The team's going to sit back in a zone, which the Blazers literally did in an NBA playoff game. You can either go, we're going to make some open shots and we're going to punish you for going in the zone, or you go, Bron and AD, you're Rashawn Prince and Jordan Bell. You got to be aliens and go in and finish through and ones. And one or the other has to happen. Because then it makes the other one easier to happen. Neither of them happen.
In a hypothetical, let's flash forward to the end of this series. If the Blazers win and Frank Vogel's doing his press conferences and he's like, hey, guys, they sat in the zone. Our only option was to shoot threes. That's all we had, and we didn't make them. You're going to be pleased with that answer? You're going to be pleased that he had one idea? Like, you got to get creative, man, on both ends of the floor. I just don't see the creativity. And that's what it's going
to
take.
I think what you just brought up is – to me, where it's way different in the NBA than it is in high school, because like Mike D'Antoni's had to give that press conference a number of times with the Rockets, right?
And Mike D'Antoni doesn't have a championship.
Yeah, fair point. I mean, he also hasn't had LeBron James or Anthony Davis. But I think what you just said is exactly right. Look, if they lose on Thursday, absolutely, right? But the Lakers and the NBA as a whole shoot 45% on what the advanced stats would call a wide open three. That means no one's even trying to run at you, right? We were 2 of 17 on wide open threes last night. If they shoot 5% below the league average on wide open three-point attempts, they win the game by 15 points last night. And so to answer your question, if they continue to suck shooting wide open threes, yeah, I think you have to make an adjustment. But I don't think they didn't lose that game until, you know, they were up by 6 with 4 minutes left in the game last night.
Yeah, but like this Lakers team sucking from behind the arc is not an anomaly, bro. We've watched that game a few times this season.
I agree with you, but 5 of 35. I mean, it was literally the worst 3-point shooting performance in the history of the NBA playoffs. So I think it's fair to have assumed they would have made 4 more 3-pointers.
And the free throw shooting wasn't great either. So I think you don't hit the panic button. It's one game. The Blazers are obviously very hot right now. Stick to, you know, trust the process, stick to the plan. Hopefully the shots will continue to fall. And then if they don't, after a couple more games, then you have to go back to the drawing board.
I'll even say one more game. JJ, we'll be texting throughout the game on Thursday night. If they lose 190-3 and go 5 of 35 from three again, running the same game plan on Thursday, I'm with you 100%. Like,
okay.
But you know what I mean?
Okay.
I just think like most of what I saw from game one was a positive. If you'd have told me we would have held them to 38% shooting, we would have held them to 100 points, which no one's done in like 35 games. I'm assuming that's a win. You know what I mean? But
okay.
To my point before, we've covered that game plenty of times for Long Beach State or for Poly, where you're going, you're doing everything you need to do at one end of the court, but there are two halves of the court. So I'll hope that either through us having two absolute aliens in LeBron and AD, or through Kuz and Danny Green and KCP being capable of hitting an open three, that the offensive end will be better even without necessarily a ton of adjustments in game two. And if it's not, then yeah, it's your job as a coach to figure out, even if the result that should be happening is there and it's just not happening.
We just talked about the Long Beach Unified School District and its teachers getting back to work. We talked about Long Beach State and Cal State Long Beach changing its mascot. We talked about the 2012 Olympics, unwritten rules of sports, and also your Los Angeles Lakers. This is the only podcast where you're going to get that type of information and that type of delivery. And you can get it each and every week right here at Long Beach Post, the 562.org, Please subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Leave us a 5-star review. Tell your friends. Let us know what you want to hear on the next episode of What Up Long Beach, and we will see you soon.